What are you having for dinner? Is it going to be herring?
I'm not big on herring, but there is, like, in Norway, there's something called fiskegratin, like fish gratin, that you can make it from scratch, but that takes a while. I kind of quite like the sort of frozen one that you get at the store, and you just heat it in the oven and for 45 minutes, and add some broccoli on the side, and that's a favorite of mine, you know.
On today's show, the great Norwegian troubadour, Sondre Lerche, talks about heartache and heartbreak, both in his own songs and in two of his favorite books, both heavily autobiographical. One is the classic French novel, The Lover by Marguerite Duras, and the other is The Story of a Marriage by the Norwegian writer, Geir Gulliksen, in which a seemingly perfect marriage quickly unravels. All that after the break.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Middle East oil exporters are racing to build pipelines to bypass the Strait of Hormuz, where shipping has stalled amid the U.S.-Iran war launched in February. NPR's Jane Raff reports.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says the Strait of Hormuz will become irrelevant in the next 2 years as new pipelines are built. But that's not how energy analysts see it.
Irrelevant is way too strong and overstated.
That's Robert McNally, a former energy advisor in President George W. Bush's administration. He and others say it will take several years for the biggest projects in Saudi Arabia and Iraq to be finished, and that pipelines will still be in firing range of Iran. And they say pipelines won't solve the problem of transporting liquid natural gas or shipping commodities such as fertilizer, where disruptions have already led to higher global food prices. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
The effects of artificial intelligence on learning are still largely unclear, but Education Secretary Linda McMahon says with guardrails, AI can be a useful tool.
I have seen it work so well in the introductions that I've seen.
McMahon speaking there to CNN, and as technology plays a bigger role in the classroom, the Education Department has issued guidance for teachers, including preserving human-centered teaching. In Nevada, around 14,000 homes in the Reno area have been forced to evacuate as a brush fire has grown to more than 10,000 acres and approaches city center. Reno's mayor says some structures have already burned. Richard Edwards, fire chief of Truckee Meadows Fire and Rescue, says others may be forced to flee the Hawk Fire and should prepare.
Make sure to have your important documents, your medications, your pets, clothing, everything ready to go.
Some 400 firefighters are battling the blaze that's being fueled by high winds and dry vegetation. Today marks 100 days since the Ebola outbreak was declared in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Michael Koloki reports Doctors Without Borders is warning the disease is still spreading at an alarming rate.
In a statement, Doctors Without Borders said that many people are dying from the disease without receiving medical care, adding that areas outside Congo's Ituri province, the epicenter of the outbreak, have witnessed a rapid rise in infection cases. According to the aid agency, Ebola treatment centers in the Central African nation urgently require healthcare workers who are trained to deal with the disease. Meanwhile, the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, has called for increased surveillance of the disease and improved access to healthcare among affected communities as part of efforts to contain the outbreak. For NPR News, I'm Michael Koloki in Nairobi.
This is NPR News. Europe is heating faster than anywhere on Earth, and it's helping feed wildfires this summer, including in former battlegrounds. As Villa Marx reports, that's unearthing a potentially deadly threat.
Occasionally, in towns and cities that once faced heavy bombardments during World War II, construction teams unearth decades-old ordinances that require bomb disposal specialists to close off entire neighborhoods to safely remove them. But in recent months, with sustained high temperatures and raging fires across the landscapes of Western Europe, rusty bombs and mines that date from the 1910s through the Cold War now further threaten the lives of firefighters as they work to beat back the flames. As the fires clear out scrub and brush that long helped bury old munitions, the bombs sometimes ignite. Blasts have so far been reported from southwest France to northeast Germany. No one has been injured. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx.
For Americans aged 45 and older, the rate of dying from alcohol use is up by about 30% since 2014, according to new federal data. It peaked in 2021, but today's rate is still higher than pre-pandemic. Deaths are around 2.5 times higher in men, but they're up in women, too. Gallup says overall, Americans are drinking at record low levels, just over 50%, as younger Americans say they are much less likely to consume alcohol. It's day two of the World Humanoid Robot Games in Beijing as China aims to showcase its dominance in advanced robotics. So far, organizers say the robots have broken 2 human records in the 100-meter dash and the high jump. Others have been less successful, tripping, falling, breaking apart, even catching on fire. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at Wallace.
What are you having for dinner? Is it going to be herring?
I'm not big on herring, but there is, like, in Norway, there's something called fiskegratang, like fish gratang, that you... You know, you can make it from scratch, but that takes a while. I kind of quite like the sort of frozen one that you get at the store, and you just heat it in the oven and for 45 minutes and add some broccoli on the side. And that's a favorite of mine, you know.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello, the Norwegian pop star Sondre Lerche has been making music and releasing albums, 11 by my count, since he was a teenager. I remember hearing his debut, Faces Down, in 2001, just a few years after I'd moved to New York, and I was swept away by his exuberant, lush pop, his swooning strings, his ear for bossa nova rhythms and jazz stylings, his slightly strange turns of phrase. It was always clear that Lerche was a romantic, but a romantic with a sometimes aching, melancholy heart. If you needed evidence of that, look no further than the 2 books he's chosen for this episode of Shelf Life, Marguerite Duras' The Lover and Geir Gullikson's The Story of a Marriage. Though very different, both novels are interested in the power dynamics of relationships and the alchemy of love. Lerche's new album, Avatars of Love, turns out to be the perfect musical accompaniment to reading his book choices, filled with predictably gorgeous meditations on love and desire and the yearnings of the heart. Sondre Lerche, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That's a great introduction. That's beautiful.
Sondre, your new album, Avatars of Love, will be your 11th, not including live albums. That's quite an achievement by any standards. You're not even 40 yet. I have an impression that you must always be writing or recording songs or thinking about music.
Yes, because I didn't go to school to learn songwriting. I just tried and tried and tried since I was 8 years old. And then, you know, when I was 16, 17, I started succeeding. I think I was just afraid of stopping because I didn't have a method. And I was afraid if I stopped writing songs, I wouldn't know how to get back on the horse. But I'm a bit more relaxed with regards to it now. I think I've come to terms with the fact that I can write songs. And I think I'm getting better at it. So this new album has been, in a way, it's the record I never thought I would be able to make. So it's been a really great rush of inspiration and stretching what I can do and what I can express and what I can articulate in music.
Well, why do you think it's the record that you felt you would never be able to make?
I think with each record, I've become slightly better at articulating lyrics with a kind of precision that gives me more ammunition when I perform. But it's been a very gradual sort of exploration. But I feel with this record, I was writing lyrics I never thought I'd write. And I was finally finding a way to talk about things that I haven't really found the language for, you know, desire and sexuality and grief. I felt very uninhibited lyrically. And it only took me 11 records to get there. So that's good.
Well, we're going to talk about this more, but I took the opportunity yesterday evening to walk around this very small town where I live, listening to the EP of Avatars of Love, which is a very good way to absorb it, I have to say. And I was completely smitten by those four tracks. And I want to just play for the audience an excerpt of Turns Out I'm Sentimental After All, if you'll indulge me.
Yes, this song is the last song I wrote. I wrote it the night before I left Los Angeles, where I lived, for Norway at the beginning of the pandemic. I think I wrote it March 12th or 13th. I was sitting alone in my little bungalow tucked away in the mean streets of Hollywood and realizing Norway was about to shut down. And I thought, it's, you know, I want to go there. I'd feel safer being close to family. I had been going through a breakup and I was coming to terms with my nature. I have a song from previous albums called Sentimentalist that proclaims I'm no sentimentalist, but here I felt vulnerable on a global scale, you know, what's happening to the world, and also with heartache and trying to move past something. And so, yeah, turns out I'm sentimental after all.
The sound of sirens carry across town. From your new corner of LA and all the way to mine, some lovers remain connected long after love was rejected. My character has broken the fourth wall. Turns out I'm sentimental after all. The grass still greener on the other side. The sea of blue, the darkened sky, surrender to the tide. Our love was so unexpected, its gentle steps undetected. Now you're the only song I can recall. Shadows fall. Turns out I'm sentimental after all. In my cold independence bed, I hide.
That was from Turns Out I'm Sentimental After All. And as I was saying, Sondre, I walked around Narrowsburg last night playing that on my earbuds, and it just was quite wonderful. I was struck by the lyric, "We try so hard to move on, still I got lost when you found someone. I asked for this, nothing could break my fall. I broke my heart, slammed it against a wall." That feels very raw, very vulnerable. Was it challenging to write some of the songs on this album?
Yeah, it feels kind of wild to even have it recited back to me, because, you know, I'm still not really used to sharing these songs. It's so early in the process. I guess one thing that's new also is that the songs really yearn to be understood. It's a very sincere piece of work. I'm not trying to muddy the waters really with a song like that. It's a very vivid snapshot to me, and it's very strange for me to share it, but I'm driven to do it, and here I am.
You've chosen these two novels that are both autobiographical, or at least semi-autobiographical. Is it fair to draw from that, that your own work is pretty autobiographical?
Yeah, you know, in the sense that it doesn't deal with invented emotions. But of course, as anyone who's writing songs or books, I'm always looking for the thing that really represents the strongest, most vivid feeling of an emotion. And I'm not trying to make, I guess, a documentary. And even, you know, any narrative is not the truth. Obviously, it's deeply, deeply subjective. So I do enjoy the freedom of songwriting, that you can be incredibly clear in the emotional weight that you're carrying, but you can still have the liberty to change the color of the house that you are in, you know. Right. You can change the location, you can do all these things. It's a freedom that I enjoy. I always, when I was younger, I was always uncomfortable when people really insisted that this is the truth. You know, I'm just singing my diary, and I'm like, well, you know, you still have to make art. There has to be a transition. I don't like the idea of writing or singing the truth just for the truth's sake, but I do like the alchemy, the artistic process, where emotion, desire, and fantasy and all these things also play a part, along with obviously the feelings that you're trying to understand really in yourself. This whole album, I wanted to have like this sense of radical sincerity, to embrace that full-heartedly without hesitation.
I like the concept of radical sincerity. It feels like this is a time and an age when we need some radical sincerity. This isn't a moment for insincerity, right?
No, exactly. It took me 20 years of making records and songs to really be able to fully inhabit that word. It may also have to do with, you know, just maturing, but it's something that's made songwriting very extra rich to me.
Take me back to young Sondra. I know you had a light bulb moment as the younger brother of two sisters who were playing A-ha, among other musical influences.
Yeah, definitely A-ha became such an obsession for me. And they were my gateway drug into music. I think when I was 4 and I heard my mother play Take On Me, actually, in the living room from the 12-inch. And as their star sort of faded, my siblings would hand me their old A-ha records. And so by the time I was 6, 7, 8 years old in the late 80s, you know, my sisters and my brother, they had new musical heroes and interests. But I stuck with A-ha through their sort of identity crisis in the early 90s even. And that became such a huge part of my identity, that group and that the obsession with their music. I wasn't interested in comic books or anything like that, but A-ha were also to me like comic book heroes, you know. There was nothing I enjoyed more than being alone in my room and being left to my own devices, whether it was A-ha or listening to A-ha or recording a radio show where I introduced the guests, and I also played the guests, and I pretended to be a recording artist with a new album. You know, I would I was happy to sort of play all these parts to entertain myself. I think I skipped a lot of sort of teenage activities by just sitting at home and doing all these things. And then, of course, eventually, as I got really good and really productive with my songwriting, I was lost, because I was just only so happy to turn down party invitations and all these experiences that I would then fantasize about experiencing in my songs.
You're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the pop star Sondra Lerche, and we're talking about two of his favorite books, The Lover by Margaret Duras and The Story of a Marriage by Gia Gullickson. Sondra, you were just talking then about these influences as a child, A-ha being one of them. I've also read somewhere that you were obsessed with the British actor James Mason, best known, of course, for playing Humbert Humbert in Kubrick's adaptation of Lolita, but also in Hitchcock's North by Northwest as the baddie and many other roles. He's not a name you get to hear too often these days.
Yeah, there was a time when I was really into North by Northwest, and I just became so, I think, sort of infatuated with his voice, his speaking voice. I don't know, it really became an obsession. I was really into Laurie Anderson and her speaking voice. And I found some of the same texture and timbre in James Mason. I don't know, just the way he articulated words and the way he tastes every syllable. And of course, he was a great actor, so he uses the voice to such great effect, especially in North by Northwest. Actually, now I want to see that movie again just to hear him speak.
It's a date. Sondre, you're talking about James Mason prompts a question, which is that you're Norwegian, but you primarily sing in English. Do you translate in your head from Norwegian to English, or do you think in English?
That's a good question. I think it varies, but, you know, I have spent the last... Now I've spent the last 2 years in Norway, but before that I lived for 15 years in America. And so, of course, when you live in an English-speaking country like that, yeah, you end up thinking and dreaming in English. I also got used to touring a lot in America before I moved there, and Europe for that matter. So I found I would just imitate my surroundings. I had a tour manager at the beginning of my career who was from California, and you know, after that tour I spoke like a Californian. You know, there's music to language and accents, but I always wanted to write songs in English, and I never tried anything else. I just grew up on MTV. All the music that I sort of admired was music in English, and if it wasn't in English, it was in Portuguese. It was Brazilian music, which is a language I have yet to learn, that I really have to learn, because I love Brazilian music, and yet I only sort of really appreciate half of it, because the lyrics really, really are important. I went to Brazil to perform, and they were like, but how are you interested in Brazilian music if you don't understand the words? What do you find there? So it made me really feel silly in a way for like loving all this music, but really, really not appreciating maybe what is to most Brazilians, at least, the most vital part of it. But it's just always felt very organic to me to want to communicate in the English language when it comes to music. And of course, I'm grateful that I have a career outside of Norway also, and that would be maybe hard if you sing in a language that only 5 million people speak.
Well, there will have been no translation difficulties for you with your first book choice today, which is Geir Gullikson's The Story of a Marriage. You were one of the readers who would have been able to read this in its original. The rest of us have to work with the translation. I have to say, whoever translated the English version did an incredible job. I love this book. And
yeah,
I am someone who tends to think I might not like what is largely or often referred to as reality fiction, which I know is big in Norway. The most famous writer of kind of reality fiction is Karl Ove Nausgaard. By chance, or maybe not by chance, Geir Gullikson, the author of The Story of a Marriage, is Nausgaard's editor. And when his book, The Story of a Marriage, was published in Norway in 2016, he insisted it was fictional, but his ex-wife, a psychologist, took to the press and lamented in an essay for a Norwegian newspaper that her, quote, love life, adultery, divorce, things which most of us want to keep private, have in my case been published. Who do you believe here, Sondre, the wife or the ex-husband?
Oh man, this is so tricky. Of course, I generally believe any artistic expression to be holy in a sense, you know, that it's excused in a way. It's outside the realm of reason. But of course, you can certainly sympathize with that statement from his ex-wife. It's kind of ironic, I guess, that by trying to tie what you see as your reality together with a fictional work, you are also drawing attention to the very thing that you are wanting people to not No. So you are also actually bringing it out into the open because you are the only witness, and that it can't be an easy thing to be faced with.
It was nominated for the Norwegian Critics Prize for Literature in 2015 and the Nordic Council Literature Prize in 2016. So a lot of people clearly loved this book. When was it that you encountered it?
Well, I think I read it in 2014. It was given to me by my girlfriend at the time, who you know, knew that I had just gone through a divorce. She was like, I think you should read this. I don't think it's for me, but I think it's for you. And she was right. That's the other thing, you know, it may be based on real lives and real experience, but that only made it more powerful when I read it, because I felt, well, this is about my life. This really speaks to my situation, even though I don't live in that house and I don't work in that company. You know, all the surface stuff is different. That's the cliche, I guess. That's the reason we listen to music and we read books, is for them to articulate something that we cannot articulate. But it's such a powerful thing when you read a book and it feels like somebody has been spying on you, you know, because it's so precise.
I mean, we should say it tells the story of a marriage and its collapse, seen from the perspective of the husband whose wife, Timmy, his nickname for her, falls for a male colleague at work. And as readers, we certainly feel that we're right there inside this marriage as it suddenly comes apart. It comes apart in spite of all the odds at the beginning, because you get a portrait of how incredibly happy this couple seem, really right up until the end. They've been together for something like 20 years. I think the narrator, John, just thinks they have something that's different and special and unlike any other marriage. And this is a point he comes back to over and over again. We're better than other people. I can allow my wife to have a friendship with another man because I would let her have a friendship with a woman. So why not with a man? Like, it's almost as if he creates or sets up the dissolution of his marriage in a strange way. It sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Is that how you saw it? That he was an agent in the marriage's collapse?
Yes. I think what really spoke to me was this kind of lover's arrogance, in a sense. This idea that we are special. We're not going to make any of the mistakes of ordinary lovers. And of course, it's a beautiful thing to feel that way. You know, it's just so naive to think that that's not how everybody feels, you know, when you're in love and when you meet someone who soothes you or who understands you, all these things, you know. When I read this book, it coming out of the collapse of my own marriage, it was incredibly specific. I really, really connected with the arrogance of sort of really wanting to just carry absolutely anything. He thinks so highly of this union and what they're made of that ends up being the downfall. And I, you know, I recognized so many things. And I thought it was just incredible the way he articulates these flaws that are sort of modern, I think, in a way. He thrives, the narrator, on feeling advanced, sensitive, not being the typical sort of insensitive male who only wants one thing. He thrives on like embodying this I think this perfect maybe Nordic man, you know, Scandinavian husband and father, and it's also his undoing and his downfall in this marriage.
Or the attributes that Sondre Lerche maybe thrived on in his marriage.
It hit me pretty hard. I definitely felt in a lot of ways that the book was holding up a mirror, and I was grateful for that. You know, I was happy to read it, and I have to say, I was, as sad as it is, of course, I think it's also funny because I was laughing at myself. I was just laughing at how I thought if I just withstand anything, if you just adjust to everything and accommodate everything, then you will be good and you will do good and life will be good. And of course, it's not true.
This is Shelf Life. My guest today is the Norwegian musician Sondre Lerche, whose 11th album is Avatars of Love. he's here to talk about two of his favorite books. Sondra, you alluded to the breakup of your own marriage, and you know, you've made a whole album essentially fueled by analyzing that or thinking about it. I know you went to see a psychiatrist for a short time. I wonder if you might talk about that and what you learned about yourself in the process, if that gave you insights.
Yeah, I learned a lot about myself, obviously. I learned a lot about the relationship and a lot of the tools for, of course, overcoming it. But I think also equal to that is reading a book like this, where you get to see scenarios that remind you of your own life from the sort of safe distance of a reader. I think it's all part of the toolkit that you're sort of using to understand what is happening. I think that album that I wrote at the time called Please, it was really just about trying to understand what is happening. And I think this book also is about that. And incidentally, this was the book I read when I released that album. So obviously all this was very fresh in my mind, and it made me feel that, you know, this book, Story of a Marriage, is the literary version of my album, Please, you know, because it really tries to assume every possible perspective on what happened. And it's so beautiful to me, but it's also kind of grotesque the way he really, really, he goes into such detail, you know, physical detail, and he speculates what she sees, what she might have thought, what she might have done. And you see that, of course, also becomes part of the problem. This idea that we can all understand each other 100%. If I learn anything, it's that it's fine that certain sides and certain parts of us remain a mystery to each other for the rest of our lives.
One of the things that struck me frequently in this book, but also in The Lover by Marguerite Duras, is the power dynamics, particularly the powerlessness of the one who is being left, sort of unable to change the course of things. And that felt very acute in this book, that he couldn't do anything about it. We might all feel our relationships are invincible or invulnerable, that they're perfect, until suddenly they're not. And then we really can't save them. There's nothing we can do.
Yeah. I think that's also where I sort of think about the sort of arrogance of love. Like when you think, I guess it's maybe a young way to think of a relationship also. Maybe that's my excuse, but when you put love on a pedestal like that, or a relationship on a pedestal rather, it's claustrophobic, because you're not entertaining any threat or any scenario that you can't overcome. You're just creating this myth of a relationship that is impossible to live up to, and it makes you all the more vulnerable when actually cracks start to show, you know, because that's not part of the image, the picture that you've put forth, and then anything becomes a threat. And I think it leaves the couple in this book incredibly vulnerable. And it's, you know, something hopefully that both me and the author have learned something from.
You're listening to Shelf Life with my guest, Sondra Lerche. We've been talking about The Story of a Marriage by Geir Gullikson. We'll be back after this.
Travelling People pass songs and tunes down the generations more than any other group. Next time on The Bucket of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear British and Irish songs and tunes from and about travellers. Join me, if you'd be so kind, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the pop star, Sondre Lerche. Sondre, I just referred to you as a pop star. Is that a term you would use yourself? I grew up in the UK, where I feel that is not freighted with judgment in quite the way it sometimes is in the United States.
I find it refreshing, really. Singer-songwriter is a little boring, and, you know, artist is a little vague. And I have to admit, I don't always feel like a pop star, but the more you say it, the more it sort of it does something to me. It seduces me a little bit. And, you know, on good days, maybe I'm a pop star. And on other days, I'm just a aspiring songwriter. But I think it's got a good ring to it. I've embraced it more. I remember when I started appearing in America and touring in America, I was really excited when, instead of just talking about the music, reviews or interviewers would describe me as good looking and handsome. I'd never heard myself described that way. I was certainly never the beautiful, cool jock at school or anything. So I remember feeling like, oh, it's kind of refreshing to be objectified like that by the American music press.
Who were you at school if you weren't the cool, beautiful jock?
You know, I was pretty socially flexible. You know, I liked attention in the classroom. So I guess you could say I could be the class clown. But at the same time, I obviously had this very pretentious, poetic side, you know, where I was much, much more interested in music and art than most people my age. And that became a very, I think, important part of my identity, you know, was that, well, I have this room that I go into with this other thing. And you wouldn't understand, you know, because you listen to whatever is in the charts. But I, you know, I go deep into the history of music, and I watch cool films and, you know, all these things.
I said earlier you've had 11 albums of original material out since you started. How many songs end up on the cutting room floor?
I'll write 25. I'll record 15 and put out 10. But with this new record, it, Avatars of Love, it's a double album, and it's pretty much every song I wrote. You know, they're pretty expansive and extensive. So there was very little left on the cutting room floor. It's simply because it all felt essential to me.
In a breakdown of the songs, you write that the song Sherlock Holmes, which is by the American sort of glam synth band Sparks, that you heard it in an LA bar just before you left the United States in March 2020. And the quote is, it came back to me in my mind a few months later when I got into some very exciting trouble. You really can't tease people like that, Sondre. You have to explain what the exciting trouble was.
Oh my God. Well, that's all on the record, I guess, the exciting trouble, or a lot of it at least. But yeah, it's funny how songs can take on a whole new meaning. They can come loaded with the way you felt in a certain moment in a completely different part of the world, and then remind you of that. But then you turn on a dime and suddenly they mean something else, and they're filled with a different meaning. That's the opposite, because they are, you know, accompanying a different memory that is being created in the very moment that you're in, you know. I'd sort of forgotten that I'd heard it even in LA, and then suddenly just came back and just really shook my world for a moment. And incidentally, that was around the time also I think I was reading The Lover, you know, so maybe that's a hint.
Well, you're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the musician Sondre Lerche, and we're talking about The Lover by Marguerite Duras. So, Sondre, you just gave us an intro to The Lover.
Yeah, but now I'm a musician and not a pop star anymore.
Well, you know, I have to vary it. We don't want to get boring, you know.
And I contain multitudes. So.
You certainly do. 11 albums worth of multitudes. So you were reading The Lover at the beginning of lockdown. Tell me about that experience and why this book, published in the mid-80s, I think 1984, by the French writer Marguerite Duras, spoke to you.
It's so beautifully and intensely written in a way. I think I had never read anything like it. I thought it was so. I think the way it spoke so frankly about desire and those things, I found that very fascinating. I think it felt like a very modern story, even as it uses so many very unique ways of framing it that are specific to time and place, and that are sort of beyond my world. And some of the obstacles are obviously connected to a different time and a different life, but it still felt like such a modern story about desire and how certain experiences can stay with you and make you really ache for a long time. It's the kind of book that I hardly recall any of the actions of it. I'm sort of just left with the feeling of it, the intensity of it. And I think, of course, that corresponds with an intensity that I was going through and that I was feeling at the time. It was just very profound to me. I think I knew that it was regarded somewhat of a classic, and I'd certainly heard about Marguerite Duras before, but I had never read any of her work. And it was a short book, so it seemed approachable and achievable. Mm. It's got like a certain magic to it that it's hard to pin down, you know. It's a strange story.
Yeah, it is a strange book, more of a novella in many ways, because it is so short. And as you say, it's not really about anything. You're not waiting for a revelation or a big reveal in the way you do with some novels. It's almost all preordained. It's told in hindsight. You know what happens to everyone. Mm. You know that the relationship with the lover is short-lived. You know that both the mother and the younger brother will die. I don't think these are spoilers, but it's almost not what the book is about.
No. All the dramatic stuff just is very sort of deadpanned. It's articulated so flat. The real heat is in all the descriptions of intimacy.
Mm. It's interesting you say deadpan. I was going to say something similar. It's kind of a lack of sentimentality. She doesn't really indulge any sentimentality. It's told in a way that is almost brutal. But we get this wonderful description of what the narrator is wearing early on the day she meets the lover. It's a threadbare, almost transparent silk dress, a belt borrowed from her brother, a pair of gold lame high heels, decorated with diamante flowers, and a man's flat-brimmed hat, brownish pink with a black ribbon around it. I loved that description, because it sort of sets her up as someone who, even as a young girl, is determined to have her own style. It sort of sets her apart and brings the notice of the lover, who is a Chinese man, very rich, very wealthy, which is contrasted, of course, with her poverty. And that's interesting too. There was a lot, without it being exaggerated, there was a lot here to do with class and with race. It's sort of, in some ways, a story about the sort of the twilight years of colonialism too. These people whose lives have been sort of flung about the world. You know, this French family that are living in Saigon. There's a large Chinese community there. And of course, all this is going to end soon. There's going to be the Second World War, and then there's going to be the Vietnam War. It's not about that, but that is the context for this story, right?
When you're describing it now, it brings back these very filmatic images, the actual color tone that I carry with me from reading it. And it sets the scene very vividly. And then in a sense, like, very little happens. It is about how this experience looms larger with every year, in a sense, because it's given this space to do so. The relationship is 18 months, but its impact grows exponentially with the telling of the memory. It's a story that has no ending, in a sense, you know, the relationship. And that's so it's so unfulfilling, you know, especially when it comes to dealing with desire.
You don't immediately get the sense that it's an equal desire between the two, between the narrator and the Chinese lover. She seems much more intent on money and he's besotted with her. But by the end, you understand that it meant more to her than she wanted to acknowledge. I think when she's going away on the ship back to France, she watches him until he's no more on the horizon. I found that very moving.
Suddenly there's a great tenderness in the description. And of course it's a complex relationship with all these elements. She's underage and he is wealthy and she's poor. There's all these dynamics that are sort of obviously sort of problematic. And I kept questioning, like, well, why am I still moved by this? There's several red flags here, but of course the fact that it is told from memory, from recollection, is sort of the thing that makes it okay, or that makes it feel like something that the narrator has really worked through, in a sense.
The book was published in 1984. One of the things that leaps out today is that the narrator is 15 and a half in this book, and the lover is 27. But Gerard is not invested or really interested in whether that's a problem. Do you think that's a problem for the novel today at all?
The saving grace is just how it's written. I think it's a testament to the incredible confidence of the writing, you know, like to express something that has such vivid passion. If you just describe it sort of coldly, then it's like, wow, that sounds... there's all kinds of problems with that, but a great writer will sort of do away with that because you're so present in the emotion. And so I just felt like that this was a writer who's really both is experimenting with minimalism in a sense, but has incredible confidence. And I think that is so persuasive.
The unnamed narrator, and I'm going to call her Marguerite because it's clearly based on her own experiences. The unnamed narrator is also using the lover to get away from her own life. And I thought this book and the flatness of the tone really reinforces that was to a great degree about depression. There's this quote, and I'm going to read it, where the narrator says, every day my mother experienced this deep despondency about living. Sometimes it lasted. Sometimes it would vanish with the dark. I had the luck to have a mother desperate with a despair so unalloyed that sometimes even life's happiness at its most poignant couldn't quite make her forget it. It's really not just the mother, but the brothers and the narrator herself that kind of live in this fog of despair and depression. I think if anyone, the narrator is determined to find her way out of it, but it doesn't really save either of her brothers or her mother. In the popular imagination, we associate Norway with, you know, depressives and a kind of winter bleakness. Is there a greater affinity or a feeling, do you think, in a place like Norway for books that deal with or touch on that darkness of the soul, on despair?
Yeah, I would think so. I think there's a sort of an understanding, a kinship in a way that is relevant. I think that what you mentioned about the sort of the depression of the family, like this desire to find another place, another sort of state of mind that frees you from the reality of your situation. I think when I was a kid, like music was the easiest sort of escape into a world that I could control and that I could be independent. And I think independence was very important to me. And music to me is independence. It's a room that I enter where I'm sort of free of other people's expectations and needs, and I only adhere to my own needs. And I think that's something that the book speaks to, the need for that room. I think only later in life did I realize that you can find that room also in a meeting with someone else. It doesn't have to exclusively only happen in music and in songwriting.
The older brother is horrible. He makes everyone's life hell. The narrator blames him for the death of their younger brother. I think he fabricates a will so that she'll be denied the inheritance. He gambles all the money. I think he ends up living in somebody's shed eventually where he dies. It's pretty bleak.
It's so bleak. And those details are the ones that really make you think that, oh, this stuff really happened, because the details are so specific. You would never invent that story in a way.
There were lots of moments where I thought, oh, this came from something that actually happened. So there's a touching moment when the mother is cleaning the house in Saigon, and it's on stilts. So they're able just to lift everything, the chairs off the floor onto tables, and just sluice water right across the floor. And it's a very happy moment. And it's such a simple scene, this sort of image of the way water just runs across the floor and then off, yeah, because the house is on stilts and I guess everything is open to the elements, and the mother is happy in that moment and the children are happy. It's just a moment of exhilaration. And again, I was like, oh, this is something she remembers from childhood. This is a real lived memory that is coming back to become a scene in this novel. I loved it.
Yeah. Had you read it before?
No, so it was a first for me. You're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the pop star Sondre Lerche, and we're talking about one of his favorite books, The Lover by Marguerite Duras. If we do things correctly, Sondre, then as we get older, we also get wiser. I remember seeing you in New York in the early 2000s, fresh-faced, exuberant, a joy to behold. But I wonder what you would say to that young Sondre Lerche in New York with hindsight.
Oh, man. I feel maybe it's typical to say to yourself, well, you know, lower your shoulders and enjoy the here and now. Don't just live in the future or in the potential that ahead of you. Live in what is actually here and now. And I think that's something that took me a long time to enjoy or appreciate. I think another thing also would maybe be some of the themes that we've talked about here with regards to the Geir Gulliksen book, Story of a Marriage, you know, is to not try to be so good and invincible in love, to not try to create this invention that's unsinkable, you know. I guess that's how the Titanic was created and sold, and you know, we see how that went.
Sondre, you said somewhere that when you started writing Avatars of Love, you had planned to write a book.
Yes, I wrote a essay collection a couple of years ago that was published in Norway in 2020, essays about other artists through my own history of being consumed with music. That came out 2 years ago, and it was a really great experience. And so I signed a book deal with a publisher here in Norway to write another, I guess, sort of a memoir. But I have been greatly delayed in getting to it because suddenly I was writing all these songs and I needed to get away to focus on that, to get started. And so I went up to Lofoten up north, this group of islands up north in the winter of last year. And I thought I was done writing the album, and now I'll focus on this. And of course, I just ended up writing another song, another big one. And that was the title track, Avatars of Love. But yeah, I've also written two children's books in the last 2 years here in Norway with a great illustrator, Victoria Sande. And it's certainly something that's made me also want to read more, because when you put out your own book, then people start asking you, so what do you read? And that's where I've often fallen short, but I do certainly enjoy writing. It's been freeing and liberating to write in other formats than just song, because songs also come with this great obligation to perform and to record and all these other things that I do love to do, but the thing that's beautiful about a book is that you just write it. The assignment ends there, really. And that's kind of refreshing for me as someone who's making records and doing tours and trying to fill the role of a pop star.
Sandro Lerke, you were holding out the best bits for last, that you're also a published author. What are the names of your children's books?
The first one was called The Christmas of the Snowman, Snowman's Jul in Norwegian. And it's a very sort of melancholic story about, you know, the fact that the snowmen are, we make them, we create them, and then we leave them out in the cold when they could use love and affection like everyone else. And so, the snowman is a sort of a metaphor for everyone who feels unwanted and who are maybe fleeing their homes due to tragic events outside of their own control. I was inspired to write the song during the migrant crisis in Europe in 2015, and to sort of underline the sentiment of solidarity with those who suddenly find themselves refugees, and then the next one is called A Fly Flew and Flew a Fly. It's the adventure of a fly who narrowly escapes death, as flies do, because they are also, I guess, unwanted. And this fly just happens to end up inside a tuba, and inside the tuba he meets a wasp. And the wasp, of course, is terrified because everybody's afraid of him, but he is actually a very gentle, sensitive soul. The fly, he wants a friend, of course, and so they start making music inside the tuba. And then, of course, when they're ready, they come out and they play along with the rest of the marching band. Yeah.
Sandro Lerche, patron saint of the heartbroken and the lost, flies and snowmen included. Thank you so much. I don't think we can say goodbye without playing the show out with another clip from your album. Are we allowed to do that?
Of course, yes. I'd be so honored.
Let's close out with some of the title track, Avatars of Love. Thank you, Sandro.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking with the musician Sandro Lerche about two of his favorite books, The Lover by Marguerite Duras, published by Pantheon, and The Story of a Marriage by Geir Gullikson, published by Hogarth. You can find this show and others like it wherever you download your podcast. My thanks, as always, to our producer, Ilya Maritz, and our sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood.
We were avatars of love. We came very close.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Do you see your partner with rose-colored glasses? Turns out, that may not be a bad thing.
We know that when people feel valued by others, it provides a strong incentive to reciprocate with positive behaviors and intentions in return.
What we project onto our partners and how those projections shape our relationships, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Monday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.